Shalom and welcome to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles. This is a recording of meaningful discussions based on the 13 Petaled Rose with Rabbi Chaim Sperlin.
Welcome to this exciting series. My name is Chaim Sperlin. I'm 37. My wonderful wife at my side now for some 14 years is here with us. You know, as if she doesn't have enough of me all day. I guess on me at night too. One of the last things my uncle, Rabbi Steindl's of blessed memory, told me was the purpose of existence is four words. The purpose of existence is four words. And then he wrote it to me. He inscribed it in a book. Lilmod, lilamed, lishmor, velasot, which translates as to study, to teach, to preserve, and to fulfill. And that's it. And with that, we can call it a night. Notwithstanding, you know, we know it all, but a wise man said that the best day in a person's life is the day that they're born. The second to best day in a person's life is the day that they find out why. So the best day is the day that we were born. The second best day is when we find out why. Well, we want to explore over the next couple of weeks that we're going to, you know, the next few hours that we'll have together tonight and over the other evenings of gathering is exactly that. How did all of this happen? How did we get here? Why did we get here? Where are we headed? How can we make the most of our, even at 37 years old, our little stint on this universe? We're not here for very long. As we all know, it goes very quickly. How do we make the most of it? And what do we do to make the most of it? So that's the overall objective here over the next few weeks. Tonight specifically, did anybody begin reading the book yet? How far did you make it?
First chapter.
You made it to the first chapter?
Second.
And oh, you made it to the second chapter?
Two chapters.
All right, because I couldn't get past the first. very good. Okay, somebody's honest. It's as you see, the ideas that we're going to be unraveling in these six lessons are ideas that may be new to some, maybe very new to some. Some of us may have heard bits and pieces of it in the past. What Rabbi Steinsaltz attempted doing in this little book is taking what we call the systems of creation. And the systems of creation is God employed a system in which the world should be created, in which creation should interact with each other. And there are many systems within this system. We're going to be talking about six of these systems. The first one is going to be, is there life outside our universe, a tour through soul land, which is one system, the system of creation. The next system is the system, my soul is on fire. That's a system of us as individuals, our souls. The next system is Bacon Holy, the system of physics. What's the relationship between physics and spirituality? Created in the image of God. That's a little bit of a reflection of the system of God himself. It's going to be a heavy one. Unique Jewish experiences is the system of mitzvahs. Living meaningfully and honestly is a great accomplishment. What do mitzvahs add to just being a good person? So mitzvahs is a system. Finally, the system of prayer. We know in Judaism, prayer is three times a day is quite a bit. What is it? What are we trying to do? So much, so often, so repetitive. It's a system within itself. Now, this is six systems that we extracted from Jewish philosophy. There are more than six in this very book, and there are more than six in Jewish philosophy, but these are the primary six that we'll be able to hopefully address together over the next few weeks. Tonight, I will attempt on system number one. The reason why I say attempt is because I believe system number one is the most complex and abstract. So if there's times over the next, whatever we have here, 40, 50 minutes, in which you lose me a little bit, that's okay. And we'll tie together, we'll regroup, we'll figure it out. I'll ask that we'll have a few segments which I'll present, and then we'll have time for questions and answers. just because the ideas that we're going to be developing tonight are deep, but we don't want to break it in the middle. So we'll try to, again, it's an attempt. I'll also say, as every good magician does, don't try this at home. I've never tried this yet. It's the first time that I'm trying this particular lesson. The others I've done. The other ones, this one, you can ask my wife. I've been distraught the past 2 weeks trying to figure out. I have it in my head. I've studied this for a long time. I live with it almost every day. But it's a system that is hard to communicate. It's almost like a language. It's really what it is. It's like another language. And it's not a language of numbers or of words. It's a completely different language. Let's jump right in. I also want to mention that I assume that not everybody will always be able to attend. Some that have registered are not here tonight that will be here. Again, every system is independent from each other. So every lesson is really a standalone lesson, although the entire series does tie together. So having the information from each lesson will seep into each other, but overall, they're individuals. Philosophers and Talmudists alike, over the past 2 millennia, have been obsessed with the universe, with the moon, with astrophysics, with astronomy, astrology. Incredibly, the Talmud and Greek philosophy has been able to map out the size of the size of the moon almost at 100% accuracy without any of the tools we have today. This is some 2,000 to 3,000 years ago. It's amazing. The obsession that the philosophers and Talmudists had with this vastness of the world around us is something that is notable by anybody. We all know this obsession. This obsession continues to this very day. The greatest of all time, maybe, Elon Musk himself, right? What's his obsession? His obsession is the universe, Mars. This world is not big enough for him anymore. This world is too small. The vastness of the universe is so so curious. Any philosopher that lies on their back on a starry night anywhere in the world, besides LA, where all you can see is streetlights, but everywhere else where you can actually see the stars, it's incredible. You can get lost, and after an hour of just looking up, and what the eye sees is less than the equivalent of a goldfish in the Pacific Ocean. What we see is nothing to what's there. Just a little slide to illustrate this. I don't even know which dot we are. It's incredible. The vastness of the universe is just incredible. Let's go a little bit more here with some specifics. If you allow me, we're going to get a little technical for the numbers people here. 1 light year is how many miles away? Anybody?
Six trillion.
Oh, it's there. 1 light year. I thought it was my next button. 1 light year. 12 zeros. Anybody ever made 12 zeros yet?
No.
That's a trillion. 12 zeros is a trillion.
It's quadrillion.
Huh? Oh, is it? Oops. Well, I'm not the numbers guy, I guess.
Yeah.
I think it's a trillion.
Million?
It's a trillion. 12 zeros is a trillion. I believe so. So 6 trillion miles is 1 light year. What we know currently, the present size of the observable universe is 46 billion light years. So 46 billion times 6 trillion miles. Anybody want to go on this tour? Now, presently reachable by us is 18 billion light years, which is a lot. 18 billion times 6 trillion. What's 18 times 6? Help me out. Everybody, at the end of the day, huh?
108
trillion miles is the amount that we have reached. So there is physical objects from our planet that have reached this space. We're talking numbers that we could just throw numbers. We can add a zero, nobody would even know. It's a good question.
Everybody.
We throw the word lightly. Does this even end? Is there an end point? In this picture, there isn't. It just, we don't know. We don't know. And because of that, the universe alone and deep space alone is enough to make our minds, to boggle our minds. The vastness and I guess emptiness of this universe just boggles the mind. Not only that, but so far, we have not yet found intelligent life after scanning 18 billion light years. Intelligent life has not yet been found. Now, the key word in space exploration, this is not a NASA class, but the key word in space exploration is not life. What is it?
Potential for life.
Now, in this 18 billion light years, they're not yet sure if they found potential for life. There's discussion about it. Maybe yes, maybe not. They're not exactly sure. Now, go back to the original picture. We're tiny, like really, really tiny compared to all this. We're the I guess, intelligent ones. What is all this about? This alone should keep us awake at night. Why are we here? What are we doing here? How did we get here? I don't know that we're going to address that question specifically, but what I want to get to from this is that the Jewish perspective on all this is that this vastness and this huge universe is only one world. And for those that started the book, you'll have noticed that this is just what we call the physical world. The physical world, the whole universe, everything that we see, everything that we know is one world called the physical world, a world that occupies physics. Now, we're going to be throwing some words around of spiritual worlds. Before we do that, I have a question for you. What comes to mind when you hear the word spiritual?
It's a self-defined term.
Intangible. What's that?
Emotion.
Very good. Emotion could be spiritual.
Something that's within us, but also that's around us and that we're looking for.
That maybe we can't see?
Yes.
Okay.
Something tangible that we're part of.
So we have intangible, we have emotional, we have. What other words?
A self-defined term.
A self-defined term.
Connection.
Limitless. All true. Yes?
I was just thinking of part of something greater than ourselves.
Okay. Very good. Very good. I hope that at the end of the 6 weeks here, we'll have a clearer understanding of the word spiritual that the Jewish philosophers threw around, of which many of these words are included. Some would argue that anything you can't see is spiritual. You agree with that?
No.
Why not? Because in the past few years, with the development of the microscope, for example, many things that were not visible for many, many years suddenly became visible to the naked eye almost. So seeing is not necessarily the definition of spiritual. It could be visible, it could be not be visible, and they could both be physical. Right here in this very room, there are many things that we don't see. The waves that are crossing and communicating with each other, we can't see it, but I don't think we can call that spiritual. These are physics. These are rules in physics. These are devices. There are devices today that can capture these waves that communicate with each other. So physics is now a new layer of physics that's been introduced, which is the non-visible layer of physics. So to say that spirituality is not visible would seem to not align so much with today's version of physics. Because today's version of physics understands that a lot of physics is not visible. Maybe most of physics is not visible. Not only that, but today's scientists would admit that we know probably nothing or very little of what actually exists right here. And maybe one day a device will come around that will be able to do even crazier things than an iPhone. That will be able to capture even more things right here out of thin air that we cannot see. So the word spiritual is beyond seeing. It's beyond not seeing. It's not that. It's something else. So to introduce the word spiritual, because that's going to be the conversations that we're going to be having over the course of tonight, I want to talk about this word in Hebrew. Hishtalshelut. Hishtalshelut. Hishtalshelut is a Kabbalistic word that means devolution. Did I pronounce it correctly?
I don't know.
The opposite of evolution. Evolution would mean, and this is the introduction of the first system. The evolution would mean that something starts in a very small way and evolves to something larger over time. It evolves to something greater over time. Evolution, it grows. Then the opposite version of that is devolution or devolution, where it starts as the largest possible and it shrinks from there. So in the worlds of creation, if we talk about creation, there is a system that God deployed. And this is system number one. It's the system of Yishtalshalut. Yishtalshalut is the system of devolution or devolution, where God begins in his infinite light with the ability to do everything, the ability to do anything. But if anything stands or if anything exists in that area, it doesn't feel itself. It doesn't carry any significance because it's in the presence of this mighty infinite existence. So nothing can exist around that. So because of that, God deploys the system of worlds that contract God himself, so to speak. Now we're going to, again, this is one of the areas that we may get a little lost. I'm going to pull you back soon, I hope. So we have the system of devolution. That's part number one. Why is this study important before we go any further? We're talking about systems of, you know, introducing the system. Why are we even talking about this? As hopefully we'll wrap up today, not quite yet, but soon, I hope that we come to these two ideas, that we recognize the cosmic impact of our actions, and that inspires us to make better choices. And I hope more that the appreciation that there's an entire spiritual realm at work, and not to get so bent out of shape from physical setbacks. If we realize that this world, the physical world, is a byproduct from an entire spiritual system, then what happens here is important. Of course it's important. That's our life. That's everything we know. But we realize that there's undercurrents that are going on in a much greater way, in a way that in a space and an existence that we maybe will never understand. But just the knowledge that there's something far larger happening than the incredible universe right here, it gives us this appreciation to sometimes take it easy. Things don't go exactly right. It's fine. There's an undercurrent that's happening that hopefully at some point we'll be able to see that what's going on right now is for the best. And even if not, we can recognize that there's an undercurrent system that's going on. I want to take a quick break and ask if there's any questions before we go to the next step here.
Just yes. One question, Rabbi. So when I was reading the first chapter, I'm not asking specific questions, but so much of what your uncle was saying, it was almost taken as a given. And I guess my question, just to rewind a little bit.
I was waiting for this question.
Yeah, just the context a little bit.
Great.
Yeah.
All right. That's going to lead us right into the next into the next part. That's a great question. What's your name again?
Josh.
Josh. What Josh asked is, we're almost talking from the middle. Like, where does some context over here? Like, what are you talking about? You know, we walk in here and we're talking about things and systems. Like, some context, where does this begin? Maybe some sources or like what's... Now, this book is sourceless. He just writes it as a thesis without any sources, not even as a thesis. There's no sources in it. Everything is sourced. He just didn't, I don't know why he didn't put the sources. I say, uncle, couldn't you just put the sources? Some of the sources will come to, but that's a great question and a very important question.
Okay.
And that's going to lead right into the next part. Any other questions?
Okay. This comes across as highly philosophical. And I never thought of myself as, I don't consider myself philosophically oriented type.
I'm going to try to roll it down and it is philosophy.
Yeah.
It is. We're going to try to apply it as much as we can in just a few minutes. We'll try.
And I've heard a lot of people declare that they're not religious, they're spiritualist, and I've never understood what the heck they mean by that.
But maybe this is what they're talking about.
Yeah, I don't know.
let's go into... The outline over here is going to be that there is four worlds. And it's an important number, the number four. Maybe we're going to, in a couple of weeks, have a chance to talk about a fifth level, a fifth world, a fifth level of existence, which is perhaps the most unique of all of them. But right now we're going to go for the four. One we already know. It's the world that we live in, the world of physics. It's not the easiest one to understand. Ask any philosopher or scientist. It's a very difficult world to understand. A lot going on over here, a lot that doesn't make sense, a lot that we did figure out, a lot that we haven't yet figured out. But this is a world that we live in, so it's a world that we're familiar with, the world of physics. When God created the world, there's three words that are spread around in the Torah that indicate creation. The first one,
Bereshit.
Bereshit, very good. That comes from the word bara. Bereshit bara. Bara means to create.
Bereshit.
Or like abracadabra, which comes from the word bara too, by the way. The magicians use that, but that's just a little parenthesis. So bara is a word that means creation. There's another word that is used, yatsar. Asher yatsar et ha'adam, God formed. We say it in the morning, one of the prayers is ata yatsarta, ata barasa, Hashem created and Hashem formed. So there is another form of creation called formation. And then there is a third one called asa, making. Now, in these three words, that would indicate, I mean, the Torah is very particular and very specific. Why is he using three different words? Why is he using three different terms? The Kabbalists learned from this that it's to bring out that there is three different dimensions to the universe, not to our universe, to the entire series of universes. There's three dimensions to existence. Now, when we say the word existence, or when we say the word universe, what does that mean? So there's a little graph here, three stages of development. This is an example. It's not how it works spiritually, but it's an example to try to bring it a little closer to our minds. There's an embryo, there's a fetus, and there's full physical maturity. These are three steps in almost every creation that exists. It starts as something that exists, and then it forms, and then it's fully formed. You have this in trees. You have this in any type of being that is, you know, that is born, or eggs, or whatever it is. These are three standard stages in which the world goes, in which almost everything that grows goes through these three steps. And these reflect, and here we'll introduce the three names of the three worlds. Asiya is our world. Asiya comes from the word action, like asa, to create, and that reflects the worlds of physics, where we're here and it's tangible and physical. The word yitzira comes from the word yatsar, which is the world of formation, and the world bria, which is the world of creation. We are missing one world still. We're going to get to that in a minute. Because the setting is somewhat with the book as the base, and some have the book, some don't have the book, some read the book, some got lost trying to read the book. So I took some pieces, some bits and pieces that we'll read together here, and we're going to go through these four worlds now from texts from the book. Before I do that, here it is. Let me do the next slide first. What is a world? When we talk about worlds, we're saying that there's four worlds. What is a world? This is page three. These factors were traditionally known as world, year, and soul. These are differentiators of worlds. Nowadays, we would call them space, time, and self, experience of one's being. Each world is distinguished from the others by the way these three factors are manifested in it. These are deep words. What they mean is something like this, that let's talk in the world of ants, or in the world of snakes or lizards, or in the world of in the world of trees. Each species has its own world. Mm-hmm. It interacts with each other its own way. One turns air into oxygen, one turns oxygen into something else. Everybody does something else with things that it was given. And each one is an entire world of its own. The ant cannot mate with a bee. The two worlds don't connect, right? So on the most basic level, when we say the word world, what it means is existences that interact with each other a particular way. So in physics, humans interact with humans a particular way. Animals interact with animals a particular way. In the world of physics, we have crossover between worlds. When a human interacts with an animal, there's a crossover between the world of the human and the world of the animal, and that's fine. There's crossover in these worlds, and that's okay. That's expected in the world of physics. I like to say that physics is like a chef. What's a chef any different than anybody else?
A chef.
What's a chef different than everybody else? When I go down the aisle in Smart and Final or wherever, Trader Joe's, and my wife tells me, buy this, buy this, buy this, buy this, I'm just listening to orders. And I put them in the cart, then I go home. When she is in the aisle and sees, she doesn't see a flower. She sees a loaf of bread. She doesn't see raw ingredients. She sees how everything ties together. The people that see it from the outside can see how the worlds interact with each other, how the world of flour interacts with the world of sugar and the world of salt interacts with the world of garlic. These are all worlds. Garlic doesn't work the same way as salt works, but when a chef could come and put everything together, the physical world is filled with this. The building that we live in, that we're in right now is a dance of worlds mixed together that a builder knows how to put this in one place and this in another place and how everything weaves together in this beautiful, harmonious way. That's many, many worlds being mixed together. But let's zoom out a second and talk about a space in which the world as we know it doesn't exist. An example for this would be, somebody would say, my mind is full with information. My mind is occupied. Your mind never fills. There's nothing that fills the mind. It's just a slang, right? But the mind is an entity, it's a universe of its own. And when the brain feels that it's full, we call it full. But it doesn't mean that it's actually full the way things are full in physics, obviously, right? We're using a term that reflects a little bit of the way we understand it, how it is in physics. So in other worlds, let's talk about the world of formation, which is the world of right above us. For example, the beings that exist there, because there are beings there, as we'll see in a minute, the beings that exist there interact with each other similarly to the way we interact here with different things. They interact there with different things, but on a completely different dimension. They don't occupy space. We cannot imagine an existence that exists but doesn't take up space. That doesn't work in our heads. We don't know how such a thing works. If you exist, you occupy space. But in another dimension, you can exist and not occupy space. That's possible. And that's what happens the minute we leave the world of physics, we enter a place where space doesn't exist, but things still exist, even in the absence of space. For example, so space is something where you'll have, here we translate space as one person occupies a space and another person can occupy the very same space, right? In another world where space will exist, just like it exists in our brains, but it works in a different dimension. Are the words coming out? You getting the idea?
Yeah.
What goes on over there? Then how do we know?
Okay, well, I think
that's a good question.
I think in terms like an ant can't conceive that there's such a thing as an elephant. That doesn't mean there isn't such a thing as an elephant.
Okay, that's
but,
a good answer.
I mean, that's how I think about things.
But I'm talking about this information or this wisdom comes from people. So how do the people know?
How do they know about this? It's a good question. It's a good, similar to Josh's question. Let's hold on to the question for another few minutes. So these worlds interact differently: space, time, and self. Now, self is the most important. The experience of one's being is the most important determining factor of how a world exists. Here, we exist because we feel ourselves. Now, in a different world, if they feel themselves as well, they will feel themselves differently. And that will determine what creates that world. What I mean to say is something like this. In this world, we feel ourselves, right? So we want to sleep, we want to eat. Ourself determines what we're going to occupy ourselves with. What are the words? The experience of our being, the experience of ourselves determines what we want to keep busy with. We want money, so we're going to go work. We're tired, so we're going to go to sleep. Ourself is what stimulates our day. That's what keeps our clock moving. The very same truth exists in the other realms. In the other realms, their existence, whatever it is, will determine what they want to do all day. So the determination, the experience of one's being is the important understanding of that universe. Now, everybody's asking, it's coming up a few times already, about the context and how do we know about this stuff? Does it? So I'm going to jump a slide here. Let's go to the world of formation right here. This is from page 4. The world of formation is the first world above us, which means that this is the first, not the most spiritual world, but the first, the closest spiritual world to our world, which means that it's the closest thing to physics that's not physics, because it's a downward spiral. So we're the lowest, we're the most physical. The world right above us is going to be spiritual, but still somewhat connected to our universe. And here we go. The world of formation may be said to be, in its essence, a world of feeling. Somebody mentioned before about spirituality being feeling. It's a world whose main substance or type of experience is emotion of one kind or another, and in which such emotion are the elements that determine its patterns. The living beings in it are conscious manifestations of particular impulses, impulses to perform one or another act, to respond in one or another way, or to the power to carry through an incentive, to realize the fulfilled tendency of an inclination or an inspiration. The living creatures of the world of formation, the beings who function in it as we function in the world of action, are called in a general way angels. And this is a key word here, because angels is a word that is thrown around in the Torah a lot. We see angels, there's angels that visited Abraham. There's angels. Where else do we have angels?
Jacob
had angels. What does it say about Jacob's angels? They went on the ladder, up and down, right? Where else do we have angels? Balak and Bilam, very good. The animal saw an angel. Very good. Where else do we have angels?
Wrestled an angel. Jacob wrestled an angel?
Yes. Jacob wrestled an angel. Very good. Passover, we get Elijah, an angel, right? Elijah the prophet, somebody mentioned. That's just in Chumash, in the first 5 books. In the Tanakh, angels are all over the place. And there are times that angels interact with us. For example, in the Torah, we have all of these experiences are humans interacting with angels. What are they? Who are they? Where do they come from? They're there in the book. So this is one of the sources that tells us that there is a being that comes from a different universe, that comes from a space that's not physical, and interacts with us by choice. They're on a particular missionary. Oh, Avram also had the angels, right? We mentioned that. So they come here on particular missions to interact with either us. In the other story, they interacted with an animal, with the donkey. There are points in time where, for whatever reason, biblical times, modern times, people talk about this, where there is this angelic, what's the word, interaction between the angel and the human. What's going on? Where did the angel come from? Do they have parents? Were they born? Are they just created? Who created them? Where do they live? Do they eat? Who are they? These are questions that when our child comes home from Hebrew school saying, like, talking about the angels, and then the kid asks the question, like, where are the angels? I'm like, whatever. But the kid has a good question. Where are those angels? Sometimes we don't pay attention to the words we say, but the Torah is filled with these beings.
We're the city of angels.
Oh, we are in the city of angels. Yeah, well said.
Yeah,
physical angels.
Yeah.
Very good. So who are these angels and where are they from? This is one of the main prompters. And thank you for bringing up the question, because when the question comes and then you get the answer, it brings a deeper insight to the conversation. These are one of the main prompters that there is clearly other beings elsewhere. Now, I don't think that we would call them interterrestrial beings that live on Mars. Because if they live on Mars and they're aliens that come down here, then they're all part of the physical universe. I'm not saying that that doesn't exist. I don't know. Maybe they do. Maybe they don't. I don't know. But if they do, we would determine that to still be part of the world of physics. Because if they came from a universe, even if they come from billions of miles away, if they came from this physical universe, then they're physical beings. And maybe they operate differently than humans. Maybe they're a type of creature that we don't know exactly what type they are, but they're a being and a physical being. Yes.
Wait, can I restate this one and see if this resonates? I'm just from my understanding. So the from a source perspective, the idea is, okay, that because these events happened in the Torah and the Tanakh, and there were angelic interactions, there were then debates about who are these beings, where do they come from, et cetera, et cetera. And so the learning that's extracted out of that is essentially distilled into what your uncle was writing about, yeah?
Not only.
Okay, okay.
Not exclusively.
Damn it, I thought I had. Yeah.
But that's correct.
Okay.
But not exclusively. In other words, a lot of these ideas have been formed through, a lot of it is in the Talmud, a lot of it is in the Zohar, a lot of it is in the commentaries of the rabbis over the generations. Some of it as old as time itself. There's a book that is called Sefer Yetzirah. We talked about it once at your house. That is the oldest Jewish book. How many Jewish books are there? Some trivia. How many Jewish books are there?
You're talking about the
theory? Huh? Jewish books.
52.
No, not biblical books. How many Jewish books?
30,000.
Oh, we're talking about like
500. There's over 500,000 Jewish books.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
An incredible number, maybe more. Literature that was written over the years. So what's the oldest Jewish book? Most people will say is the Torah. But we have a book, the small little book, called Sefer Yetzirah. Sefer Yetzirah, some people argue that it was written by the first man, by Adam. Some people say it wasn't written by Adam, it was written by Abraham. Either way, it seems to be a book that precedes the Torah itself. And some of these ideas are in that book. It's an ancient book written in Hebrew. Take it or leave it. Some people say Rabbi Akiva wrote it, so then it would come from a bit of a later generation. But either way, these things have been formulated over the years from many, many sources in many places. But it's important to ground it on a biblical verse or a biblical story, a biblical space where we see these existences. And one of those places is we had before is the words that are chosen, that the Torah chooses to use for creation, which is these three words of creating, forming, and action, and acting, which is three words that indicates that there is three different ways to create or three different dimensions that were created. But another anchor for this theory, for this idea, is angels. Angels seem to be, unless we want to say that angels is a type of person, which the Greeks actually believed that a person, a human, had the ability to become an angel, which is a completely different philosophy than ours, but they believed that humans had the ability to refine themselves so deeply that they would not need and not require the needs of physical beings. They wouldn't have the needs of sleep or eat. They would become, they would graduate from this and become, but we're going to spend some more time on a later lesson. But the idea of angels alone are the beings that occupy the world of formation. So what we have now, just to zoom out for a second, what we have now is that there is an entire universe of action. With all its beings, with humans, with animals, with the bio kingdom, with creatures, everything that exists here that interacts with each other, and then suddenly, every so often, there is a pierce into our universe where there's an interaction from a different universe. Now, does our universe interact back? Can we go to Angel Land? Can we as physical people go there? It's nice that they could come here, but I would like to go on a trip there. We could go there?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So there were some, and the Talmud describes a story, well said. The Talmud describes a story of four rabbis that go into a cave, and it seems like they went into a deep type of meditation where they attempted to interact with these spiritual worlds above us. And three were not successful, but one was. Rabbi Akiva was successful in that interaction. So it seems that there is possibility for cross interaction. What's that? Some will say that that's, that that reflects that experience too. Yes, well said.
Who else was the one who never died but was kind of like taken up into?
Oh, yeah.
So somebody mentioned Eliyahu, Sarah Bas Asher, it says, the one who sang to Joseph, to Yaakov, that, that Joseph was alive. The Medrash writes that there were seven individuals that went to heaven without, that went to heaven. Where is that? I don't know. They went to that other dimension without physically dying. Exactly what that means, again, it's hard to comprehend. So far we have the world of angels. Yes.
Some people believe that we all get glimpses of that, that travel.
That we get what?
We get glimpses. We all are able to have glimpses of that world, those other worlds.
Some will argue that levels of intuition come from there, correct intuition. These are pointers. These are pointers.
Rabbi, you asked if we could influence that world.
Yes.
Right? So one thing, I just, can't we influence that world through prayer? And
very good.
And also the angels are seeking to interact with us, or they're being told to interact with us. So there's something about our behavior that is making that connection
very good.
Necessary. Or,
very good. And very, very good, Denise. What Denise is saying is that why would an angel choose to interact with us? Obviously, there was something that we did or something that happened here that stimulated, that called, you know, that called that put in that request, you know, that pressed that stewardess button, right? And called that angel in, which is a very good point. And this is what's unique about our world. The world of the world of action, the world that we live in, is actually a bi spiritual physical world, because we have a soul, as we'll discuss later on. But it's important to just drop it in here as well. We have both. We have both dynamics. The world of formation, for example, the world of angels, they don't have physics there. They're a one dimensional universe. They're a one dimensional world of the spirit connected to emotions, as mentioned. But this world has the ability to mesh between spirit and physics. And that's something very unique. And perhaps, this is at least what the argument of the rabbis is, that this world having that cross-denomination of ourselves, spiritual and physical, is the greatest accomplishment of existence. Having something which is purely physical is amazing. Having something which is purely spiritual is amazing. But putting the two together is a complete explosion of universes. And that's something very unique. That's hybrid of so many things. Hold on, let me go a little further here. Where the clock is ticking. here is an important piece from page 6. The real difference between man and angel is not the fact that man has a body, because the essential comparison is between the human soul and the angel. The soul of man is most complex and includes a whole world of different existential elements of all kinds, while the angel is a being of single essence and therefore in a sense one-dimensional. In addition, man, because of his many-sidedness, his capacity to contain contradictions, and our gift of an inner power of soul, that divine spark that makes us human, has the capacity to distinguish between one and another, especially between good and evil. It is this capacity which makes it possible for us to rise to great heights, and by the same token creates the possibility for our failure and backsliding, neither of which is true about the angel. So the angel doesn't have, the angel is try to think of it almost as a tree. It has a purpose, but it doesn't seem like it can move anywhere other than it is already. It's one dimensional. It's here for a purpose. It does its purpose and it keeps going. It is what it is. Whereas the human is very complex. And that complexity is a product of our universe, which is unique to our universe, which is unique to the world of action.
Are you suggesting that the angel in its spiritual world does not have free will?
That's a very good question. That's a really good question. What's your name again?
Michael.
Michael's asking if that would indicate that angels don't have free will. What's the Christian answer to this?
I don't know.
Why is Satan damned?
Because he uses free will.
Because he uses free will, and disobeyed God, and he'd be damned, right? The Jewish perspective on this is the opposite.
Yeah.
Interestingly, that we believe in Satan, in a negative force in the world, and Satan is created by God, not because it did anything wrong, and not because it'd be damned. It was created here for a particular reason, to keep us in line, to tempt us sometimes, and we should overcome those temptations. And Satan is serving God equally as the greatest angel, Raphael, Gabriel, Michael, and so on, which is a completely different perspective on how we see angels. So what you're asking is a very good question. Do they have free will? Mostly we believe that they don't. There are places, there are sources that will indicate that they do. And it turns out that there are two types of angels. Some do, some don't. But the types of angels that we're talking about here, the majority, and look, nothing in Judaism is going to be, the one way and one way only. But typically what we're talking about over here, and that's a great illustration, that they are byproducts of their universe, and they're not there to serve with choices. And that's not their purpose. That's our purpose. Our purpose is to battle with light and darkness and choices and questions and this struggle of life. That's not the purpose of the angels' world. They have a different reason of being. Okay? That's a great point. I want to go to the world of creation. Here, let's do this quickly. Here is our summary for the world of formation, which is Yetzirah. They are sent downwards for a particular mission akin to a cross of worlds. Then when a bacteria attacks a colony, there's an outside guest that is coming into another world. Anybody ever heard of Trichogramma wasps?
I think so.
Trichogramma, you know these guys? They're amazing. Huh? So a couple years ago, we're struggling, like many people here in LA, I assume, with some moths. What are they called? Pantry moths.
Mm.
You can't get rid of them. You finally find the bag, you throw the bag out, and then find another bag. So I was doing some research because that's what I love doing. And there's this type of they're called Trichogramma wasps. You can Google them. They're like a quarter inch, no less, not a quarter inch. They're millimeters big. You could see them. They're tiny, tiny, tiny wasps. They call them wasps. I don't know why. They don't sting and they don't look anything like a wasp, but they're called wasps. And they lay eggs in the same egg as moth eggs. Who figured this out? I have no idea. But, you know, give something to my uncle. He was a zoologist for many years. He worked at the Biblical Zoo in Israel, in Jerusalem. They have the Biblical Zoo, the Gan HaChayot HaTanachi. He wrote actually some books in zoology. He loved animals. We used to walk in Jerusalem together, and any little thing you would see running around, he would tell me who their grandparents were, who their great-grandparents. He knew everything about these little bugs. Incredible. And the Trichogramma wasp is, they have different types. Some are east of the Rockies, west of the Rockies. It's an entire universe, literally a universe. And they come and they lay eggs in these moth eggs, effectively killing the moth eggs. Now, you say, okay, so you killed the moths, but now you have the Trichogrammas. The Trichogrammas die in 24 hours. They lay the eggs in the moth eggs, and I don't know how they continue existing, but you can see them crawl up around for a couple of days, and then they're gone. So, again, who figured this out? I don't know. But it's incredible. But what this is a crisscross of worlds. You have the Trichogramma wasp who's coming and hijacking the moth. And you say, who invited you to my party? You don't look like me. You don't dance like me. You don't sing like me. What are you doing in my eggs? But that's what happens. The world is created with this crisscross. And when angels come to our world, it's exactly the same thing. There is this crisscross of universes where an angel is coming and hijacking our universe for some particular purpose and some particular reason. And hopefully, you know, we say hijacking, it sounds in a negative way. Generally, angels, not all, but generally, we mentioned Satan. There are some angels that are here to make trouble. Generally, angels are sent here to bring salvation, to bring inspiration, to bring good things. They come from a space where spirituality is open to them. They come from a space where goodness is clear to them. Anyway, so that's a summary of my sugar grandma's. I had to put it near somewhere. So we found it. Let's go to the next world. Immediately above the world of formation is the world called the world of creation, which, like the others, includes many different realms and levels. And just as the world of formation is comprised of a multitude of spiritual beings whose essence is pure feeling and emotion, the world of creation is a world of pure mind. This mind quality of the world of creation is not a merely intellectual essence, but rather expresses itself as the power and capacity to grasp things with a genuine inner understanding. Let's go just a little further. The creatures of the world of creation, the living souls in it, are the higher angels called seraphs or seraphim. Ever heard the word before?
Yeah.
We say it on Shabbat in one of the songs in Keladon, Srafim Ofanim the Chayot HaKodesh. And that's referring to three types of angels, different names of angels. So again, we see that there's different dimensions and different types of angels. Where does that come from? It's another layer of context to the existence of beings of another sort, of yet another sort. So here we have seraphs, or seraphim, they're usually called in Hebrew. Seraphim is also an angel. The word angel, actually, in Hebrew, translates as the word messenger, which is a conversation of its own, but just keep that in mind. Whereas the angels of the world of formation are embodiments of pure emotion, those of the world of creation are essences of pure intelligence. The seraphim are angels who manifest the highest levels of the mind. They also reflect the differences among various planes of consciousness and comprehension, in itself a particular aspect of mind. Finally, every such creature of the world of creation also serves as an angel messenger, receiving the plenty from the angelic beings and the souls of the world of formation and raising them up to a higher level in the world of creation and further to endless heights. So we have so far the system that we have in place is something like this. And again, I've never been there, so I'm not talking, explaining of this space that I have been to and I'm showing you around. This is here, this is here. I'm talking from information. You know, I've studied this, and I hope to be able to impart some of these ideas because they're fascinating. What we have here now is a composition that goes something like this. The world of action, which is our world, we know how it works. An insight to the way the world of formation works is emotional. That's the primary stimulation of that world. It's all emotional. Exactly what that means, I don't know. But it starts and ends with emotion. That's the you call it in Yiddish the kochlafel. That's the mixer of that pot. The world of creation, which is the upper world that we're talking about, the third from here, that world is a world of intellect, and intellect is a completely different universe of its own, which we could understand from our experience too. We can do different than we feel, and we could feel different than we think. They all exist in their own space, which just brings out the complexity of the person. You know, you want to do one, you could do one thing, you feel something else, the mind is telling you to do something. We're torn in so many directions. Part of being, because this is the system of creation. The system of creation puts these pieces together, starting as separate spaces, and then in our world kind of meshes it all together. So the world of creation is a world that's highly intellectual. The beings of that world operate from a space of the mind, and their purpose and interactions with us is far less than the interactions of the lower world. Usually when we see that angels interact with our world, we're not talking about these angels. These angels are, what would you call them? They're arrogant professors. They don't like the commoners down here on planet Earth. So they very rarely interact with our world. Something more than that is that there are souls, which we're going to talk about in lesson three, in the next lesson, we're talking about our souls. There are souls that are byproducts of different worlds. So a soul that is a byproduct of the world of action, which is a possibility, is going to be more of a coarse soul. A soul that's a byproduct of the world of formation is going to be more of an emotional soul. And a soul that's from the world of creation is going to be more of an intellectual. And we see that manifesting physically here. You know, you could have we're blessed with twins, identical twins, and you see two different personalities. I don't need anything more to the nurture or nature question. I know the answer. There's a ingrained difference between these two people. I don't know how. They ate the same. They grew up the same place. They live in the same room. I mean, they have been feet apart from each other their entire life. And they should be so different. And they're identical. That, it really doesn't make sense. But if we appreciate that their souls could manifest itself into them differently, maybe one has a soul from one world and one has a soul from another world. And the distribution of souls doesn't follow the rules of distribution of bodies. The distribution of bodies follows, you know, chemistry or whatever it is that, you know, they're identical. Their DNA is the same. The distribution of souls doesn't work that way. One may have gotten a soul from one world and they're going to be the intellectual, and one got a soul from another world and they're going to be the wild one. And this is one of those spaces where we see again this this interaction between the universes. Where are we here? Till when are we going?
Till you get tired.
Till I get tired. I want to drop two words quickly, and we're gonna head towards wrapping this up. Just quickly, the word in Hebrew is yeshut, which means existence or ego, and the opposite of that is the word bittul. Bittul means surrender, suspension, and nullification. When does a person surrender? When do one of us surrender? When do we ever surrender? When do we need a surrender? When we want to do one thing and somebody else who is stronger than us wants us to do something else, right? Present company excluded. When we want to do one thing, our wife wants to do us to do something else. What do? Or our spouse wants us to do something else. We surrender because that's the right thing to do. Yes? So surrendering is the very existence that two things are occupying, are trying to occupy the same space. And one says here, one says here. What are you going to do? Only one can be in that same space at the same time. There is a battle between existence for space. We know that in physics. This we know from trees, right? The wild trees, you can see this on any of these Planet Earth or any of these docuseries, is that every leaf is in a battle with its sister leaf. For sunlight, for wind, for some raindrops. It's incredible what goes on over there. They might even be twins, those two leaves. They might have the same DNA, but they're in a battle with each other, right? Because one is in a space that the other one wants to occupy. So one is going to have to surrender, and one is going to win, right? Now, in physics, who wins? The stronger one.
Mm-hmm.
Who surrenders?
The weaker one.
Usually, right? Now, we don't have to go anywhere outside physics yet. We could stay in physics and have the same question in the world of the mind, intellectually. A husband and wife are in an argument, right? And the husband says one thing, the wife says something else. Who's right? Everybody knows who's right. Not a question who's right, right? You don't want to be right. You want to be happy, you want to be right, right? It's not a question about right anymore. Now, the person who surrenders might not be weaker. The person who surrenders might just be smarter, right? So now surrender is not anymore a sign of weakness. Surrender might be actually a sign of strength. So when there's two leaves fighting with each other, surrender is a sign of weakness. When there's two crabs fighting for the space under the rock over there in the edges of the ocean, the one who gets the space is stronger than the one who he keeps, pushing away. But in the world of the mind, or even emotionally, many times, surrender is a sign of strength, not a sign of weakness. And the spiritual worlds work exactly that way. Surrender is a sign of strength, not a sign of weakness. This is one of the spaces where it's counterintuitive to the way our world works. Our world tells us that if you surrender, you're weak. The spiritual world says that's not the case necessarily. And when we are beings that can mesh the two worlds together, we have that ability to choose and say, I could surrender and be strong. I don't have to surrender and be weak. This is a parenthesis, but I think it's an important one. It illustrates a little bit where these worlds do not see the universe the same, where each world has a different sense of self. The sense of self in physics is going to be different than the sense of self in formation or in creation, in Yetzirah or in Bria. And we started with that the sense of self is going to be the determining factor of how that world operates. It's very important to be able to clearly identify what is that sense of self there. A couple of years ago, it's not so popular anymore. I think it's true. I think that they were onto something, but now I've moved on to other spaces. But in the area of psychology, self-esteem was what everybody was talking about. The cause of everybody's misery was self-esteem, and the cause of everybody's success was self-esteem. Self-esteem was the beginning and the end of our entire psychological universe. Now, things moved a little bit over the past couple of years and moved on to trauma, moved on to other things that the person can have healthy self-esteem and still be scarred from other things. So self-esteem is not anymore seen as the singular item that dances around, but self-awareness is going to be the determining factor of many, many things in our universe. And instead of looking at self-awareness at ourselves for a minute, and this is where this is where the conversation shifts from philosophy to action, to the practical world. When we see self-awareness from the lens of not ourselves, but another, then we could ask ourselves, what are they feeling that's making them behave that way? And now maybe I could approach them differently. Instead of being occupied in my self-awareness, and then all I see is myself, and the only space I occupy is my own, I try to see the other person's self-awareness. What is their self-awareness? And every person is a world, right? Every person is an entire world. What is their self-awareness? The minute I move out of that, now I'm seeing a new universe. So this is an important parenthesis. It's where these things become a little bit more practical. You want some Kabbalah diagrams?
Sure. That looks practical.
This is an illustration that was written by Shapta Levi Horowitz about 500 years ago. What he wanted to illustrate is that the center is what he would call the ultimate creator. God himself is the center. And then anything that moves further away from the center, further away from God, becomes more and more self-aware. Because anything that's at the center cannot feel themselves. God's presence is too powerful for anything there to feel themselves. So self-awareness grows as you move along. And he has all different levels, so water and wind and earth and then angels and creation and formation and emanation, and it goes on and on. We didn't get to world number one, but maybe we'll leave that for now. So here's a state of mind. A seer reality is that God feels somewhat distant from us. Yetzirah reality is the emotional reality where we sense God's presence. The Bria reality is being overwhelmed by his presence, which is something that we feel very rarely, if at all. Bringing things practical, which is also a good way to close, I think, is we have these three things in our daily life. We have Bria, the world of creation, to contemplate God's relevance to our lives, which is the mind, meditation. Recite Moda'ani, which is verbalizing gratitude for the gift of another day. That is more the emotion. That's where we cross into the emotional world. We're bringing it down into the emotional world. And then wash our hands as the priests did when preparing to serve in the Holy Temple. That's Asiya, that's an action. This is something that that some do every morning within 5 minutes. They start their day with introducing ourselves and those universe, like bringing all these worlds together. We bring the intellectual world of a small meditation of God. We say words, which is formalizing this and bringing it closer to our existence, and then finally in action. This is what I'm going to close with. The Purim story is a classic crisscross of realms. Today is Shushan Purim. Today we conclude the holiday of Purim. Today was celebrated in Israel. Today was celebrated for those that, I don't know if there's any Jews anymore there, but in Hamadan, they're still celebrating Purim on the second day. If there's any Jews there, I don't know. How many times does the story make us ask, that's unusual? Let's go through the Purim story just briefly. Ahasuerus throws a party, right? Middle of the party, he calls upon his queen. His queen doesn't listen. That's odd. Why wouldn't she? What's the big deal? Join the party to execute the queen? That's odd. Keep going another chapter. Mordechai hears two guards plotting to kill a king. He knows the languages because he was part of the Sanhedrin, so he knows 70 languages. He tells it to Esther. That's odd. Then you go on to another piece in there. Go through the next story. Again, it's odd. And the entire story of the Megillah occupies 7 years. It's a 7-year story. We read it in about 15 minutes, but it's a 7-year or 30 minutes or whatever. It depends how many times you wave the gragger, but it's a 7-year story from beginning to end. And Esther becomes queen early on, where there was no crisis yet. There was no decree against the Jews yet. None of that happened yet. And meanwhile, early on in the story, there's already things that happen that, that's odd, that's odd, that's odd, that's odd. And only later, after 7 years, like, aha, that's why that happened. And that's why that happened. And that's why that happened. And what's really going on is that Purim is a classic story that happens really every day of our life. It's really the story of our life, of this crisscross of the world. We don't get to see it. We don't get to see the 7 years full picture of everything that happened and every time another angel pressed a button and every time God called on an angel to do this and to do that and to run the world a particular way. We don't get to see the whole picture. But one thing we get to see is that what we see today is tunnel vision from the larger universe that exists, the larger physical universe that exists, certainly the larger spiritual universes that exist. And as we began with, if this idea can bring a little bit less tension to our lives, that there's a plan, there's a grand plan. We see, again, less than a tiny goldfish compared to the Pacific Ocean of the physical world, never mind the spiritual world. And this gives us a little bit of I think, inspiration, a little bit of lightnessness. We can carry on life a little bit lighter, accept the day, accept the challenges as they come a little bit easier, and also the opportunities. The world is tiny, but it's very, very large. That closes today's lesson. Anybody has some questions? I want to give before I close. Actually, I want to give a big thank you to AJ for making this happen. When the idea came up originally, AJ said, "You know, I think it would be great. Let's do it. Let's try." And I said, "AJ, it's a great idea." And he's like, "I don't know. I don't know for sure that it would work, but let's give it a try." And I made a deal with AJ some time ago. I said, "Even if it's just me and you, it's a win." So I'm glad that it was me and you. And look at all the guests that joined us as well. So thank you for coming. Thank you for coming out. The next one is in 2 weeks from tonight. Again, I want to mention, I think it's important to mention, tonight's was the most abstract from all of them. I hope that I was able to fill in these worlds and these gaps a little bit, and I'm here for questions.
Yeah, are you recording?
I believe it was recorded. Yeah.
So each session will be recorded?
That's the plan.
It'll be put on the Tumblr by the podcast.
We get the recordings and not here.
Hopefully we'll be able to do that, yeah. That's the plan.
Yeah, that's what we're working on.
Podcast version or
Again, it'll be on the Temple by Thong podcast, and I'm almost doing it. So
I have a question about it. Was not something we spoke about here, but something else in my book. And it was about how mitzvot have the possibility to, by a shepherd, create angels.
Yes.
And it was an example of how it was written pretty quickly, matter of factly. And I it was one of the things I found most challenging about. It was just an assumption that is pretty critical to this entire system.
To the whole system.
Yeah, I thought that was a metaphor. I was trying to wrap my head around that.
Around that particular piece?
Literally that statement. Like,
so just to fill everybody in, there's a statement that says that angels, one of the ways that angels are created is by doing mitzvot here, we create angels in those realms.
Yeah.
And again, there's no source there. It doesn't give any explanations. Like 5-6 lines, he drops a line and he keeps going. It's a great question. It's very much connected to this conversation. We will talk about it more in the mitzvahs in the mitzvahs class, which is I think the second to last one. But not to leave it undone, you know, not to address it for a moment. Yeah, whoever wants to go, feel free. Absolutely. To address it just for a moment is something like this. The theory argues that time in this world is captured and stored for eternity. Time doesn't pass and leave. The proof for that is because time doesn't exist in other realms. This we know from Haya Ve'Yiyeh, God is, was, and will be all at the same time. It's hidden in his name, Yod Heh Vav Heh, which is a cross of past, present, and future all in one. So the theory argues that time is captured and stored for eternity. Now, where is it stored? How is it stored? It's stored in an angel. Because what an angel is, there's not like angels exist. If you go far enough, you're going to find the world of angels, right? He writes something like that. It's not like it's in a space that's a couple miles away. That gets captured in a form of a being. Every moment and every action is a being in time. And that being is something that remains in existence forever. How does it remain in existence? In the form of an angel. And that angel could later come. That captured moment, today it's a lot easier to understand it with devices that can capture time, with memory cards. Imagine that memory card could come later and remind us of something that happened then, right? A picture. It's captured in time forever and in a form of an angel. And that's what a mitzvah, what he writes over there in those 5 lines, is that a mitzvah does that. A mitzvah captures in time an angel. Now, really, not only a mitzvah. Everything is captured in time. But a mitzvah is captured in time in a more spiritual way, as we'll discuss there. So not to leave it undone, but that's a great question. It's important stuff. Yes?
I had a question about, sure. You started with the comments about devolution or ishtanshelut, and it sounded like you were saying that the dimensions were contracted.
Yes.
But then when you discuss the different worlds, it actually sounds like it's quite the opposite. So could you sort of repeat that in a way that we would understand it now after the discussion?
Good point. The way for us to understand it better is to start from what we know. What we know is our world. And then go a little bit above, and a little bit above, and a little bit above. As we go higher, it becomes less and less understood to us, right? It's becoming more and more abstract. But from God's perspective, in the top is where his existence is absolute. And there's no existence that denies his existence. The denial of his existence starts growing as we start going further down. And then we come to a world here that most of the world denies his existence. Incredibly, right? So from the perspective, from God's perspective, it's a devolution because it gets smaller and smaller as far as what we would call letting him in. But from our perspective, it becomes more and more abstract as we go the other way. Does that make any sense? So point very well taken. It's confusing because when we talk about devolution, it means that it's getting smaller. Meanwhile, it seems like here's where it's at. And it's to add, this is a reflection of the fifth dimension that maybe we'll make it to at some point. The fifth dimension is going to be the dimension that explains that this universe, that this world, our physical Earth, our planet Earth, actually, the smallest, tiniest little planet Earth, is the most deepest connected to God himself. And all the layers in between are byproducts as part of the system. You understand? So actually, this ends up being not a devolution, but this ends up being the ultimate as well. So it's a circle. Our brains are going to explode soon. I should have finished with the slide of that emoji with the exploded head. Yes. 1 second. You had a question. Yes.
I have a question about your uncle's concept of the soul. There was a sentence in chapter one that just struck me as so powerful that I underlined. I kept going, I turned the pages and I went back to it again. It just kept coming to me. It says, what we call soul is in the physical dimension, the totality of living creatures functioning in the time and space dimensions of this world. And that just seems like such an amazing concept, because I think we often just sort of think of like one person, one soul, to the extent we think about that at all. This seems like a much more like transcendent, all-encompassing sort of vision of what the soul is. I was just wondering if you could talk about that.
Let's leave that for next session. No, that's gonna be the it's gonna be one of the important ideas that we're gonna attack next time we gather. But that's a great one. I should turn that into a slide. Once I get a question.
No,
you're good. Yes.
Could you just take 1 minute and just give us some quick context about your uncle? I mean, was he born observant? What was
he's a great
what was the context he was okay. coming out of intellectually?
He had a favorite baseball team.
That was and his color that he had.
Now that I showed you my colors, I can tell you that he's not my blood uncle. He married my aunt.
Okay.
So, you know, I love him a lot. And I learned a lot from him, but unfortunately we're not blood related. he grew up in a Jerusalem family, secular Zionists in the 30s. His father, those that are familiar with a little bit of history, the original secular Zionists were very, very well-versed in Torah. They were brilliant. Many of them had a deep understanding of Tanakh and of the Talmud. And they had I don't know what the word is, but they had a very webbed perspective on how the modern state of Israel will address a lot of the literature of Judaism of 2,000 years. Many of them felt that the 2,000-year literature has been a product of the exiles, and much of it should not exist once we're back in Israel. And a lot of this perspective has been forgotten, but it's interesting, the founding members of the Zionist movement, many of them had this philosophy. His father, Rabbi Steinholz's father, was one of those with that philosophy. So he was a scholar. He was a scholar that believed that the state of Israel has to bring the modern state of Israel has to bring in a new era. And he saw what he noticed in the early years. This is before he was born, before the establishment of the state. But what he noticed in the formations of the schools that they were having at the kibbutzim and the different schools that were being put together, he noticed that they were eliminating Jewish textual study. They weren't teaching the kids Tanakh. They weren't teaching them Talmud. And he found that to be counterintuitive. He said, we should teach them all this stuff and explain to them that today in Israel, it's a different world, but not that they should become, he said, I don't want them to be ignorance. I don't want them to be ignoramuses about the. So he sent his son to yeshiva, but on one condition, that whatever he learns in yeshiva, he should be able to use to further the Zionist idea that none of it is relevant. What happened was is that he went to yeshiva and he liked it. And he kind of went a different path. So about 68, at a very young age, he showed signs of geniosity. So they were very careful not to allow him to explore his mind. And he was reading everything. He wasn't just reading Talmud. I mean, in his house, he had a library, a crazy library. He was reading everything he was able to get his hands on. He's an absolute brilliant mind. But one of the interesting, he would say about his father, he says, had his father known that he would become who he became in the, you know, religious world, he would have never sent him to Egypt. Says that was not what he wanted. He didn't want any of these books. He didn't want, you know, he just wanted him to be a furtherance of his agenda. And interestingly, that didn't happen. Now, he ended up marrying my aunt, which is a great story. He had a Kabbalah class that he would give once a week in Jerusalem in his youth. He was in his young 20s. And it was a class that he would give to Knesset members and some other like high profile people. And there was this girl that came from originally born in Russia, but then ended up in France and went to, I believe it was Hebrew University. I think Hebrew University was already open. She went to study in Jerusalem and she heard about these classes and she decided that she's going to go attend them. And she used to walk him home. And that was it. Well, yeah.
That was the beginning.
That was the beginning.
So was it written in English or in Hebrew?
This was originally, so this book he writes in his introduction, similar to the series of classes that I told AJ, I don't know who's interested in this stuff. He wrote this as a note to himself in Hebrew, not thinking that, you know, people are really going to connect to these, you know, these mystical ideas and stuff. And eventually it got out there. He published it. It got out there in Hebrew. And then it went wild from there. And that's when he translated it into other languages. And it became a bestseller.
So it's his translation.
Yeah. He knew a few languages. I mean, there was an editor at Tzachi HaNegvi. I think it was not Tzachi HaNegvi. What's his name? There was a translator. And then he overlooked. He had a very nice English. You could hear him like this British English. Because he was born under the British mandate. They were speaking. There was English being talked. The original... You hear those that have the Israeli British English. It's a very nice English. So that's my, and then I spent 2 years in yeshiva in Israel, and I hung out with them a lot. Every time I had a Shabbos off, I would go there. We connected. We take long walks together. He was just one of a kind. The only day a week that he had for his family was Shabbos. The rest of the week he had we'll talk about his schedule. Maybe he did 2 hours. He did 2 days for every 1 day. He did 2 8-hour work days for every single day. He did 8 a.m. to 4. He would take a nap. And then he would do 6 p.m. to 2 a.m. And then eat whatever, breakfast, dinner, sleep till 8, and then go again from 8 to 2. So he had, for every 24 hours, he had 2 full 8-hour work days. When he died, I said he didn't die at 80. He died at 160. Yeah, no, he lived 2 full lives. It's incredible. Mm. So the only day that he had was Shabbos. Shabbos was a day that he couldn't. He would read, but he would get. Shabbos was a day that he gave to others, so to speak. And I'll never forget those walks, those talks. Heck of a guy. Yeah.
So, as I understood the first chapter, your uncle believes, as a lot of, I would guess, ultra-Orthodox Jews believe, that God is the all-being, all-perfect, whatever. Okay. I'm curious if over the course of these classes you're going to have, is there any world or experience where you can challenge God, like people challenge their president or their rabbi or their boss or whatever?
That's a great question. We didn't dedicate in these 6 weeks a specific time or discussion about it. But again, not to leave it undone, Moses did it. I think he was the greatest rabbi who existed. If he did it, I think anybody can. We believe in questions.
Abraham
did it. Everybody. Yeah. We talked about this some time ago, that almost every one of these characters, biblical characters that we have to this very day, are those that challenged, those that battled. You know, the easy ones, we don't remember who they are.
No.
Who God rescues.
Exactly. I don't think that's... I don't know where it's become that some people frown on it. I don't know. Questions are allowed. Conclusions are something else. To say that because of these questions, therefore, That's something else. But the questions, Moshe had the questions, Avram had the questions, King David had the questions, and Max had the questions. King Max.
Can I ask you a question?
Of course. I know the other questions.
I don't know if there's a connect, like, because I'm sure there's more to talk about with the distribution of souls, right? Mm-hmm. And that may sort of be where it goes. But when you describe the different worlds, you know, formation and all of this, right? That the what stirs the pot, the spoon that stirs the pot, the motivation or the catalyst, right? You know, we have our different levels, but in this world, there's a lot of thinking that happens. There's a lot of feeling that happens in addition to a lot of action. So how are those things reconciled briefly at the end of the day?
You're saying that you notice that this world seems to be more complex than the others?
It's got all those other elements. Plus, like if you're describing that it's pure thought, right, all the way up with the seraphim. Okay, great. There's a fair amount of thinking happening around here, I've noticed, right? Maybe it's not all good thinking, but we're thinking
right
in this world, right? So that doesn't seem to match up with pure this, pure that.
And then suddenly chaos.
And we're in the world of pure action. No, we're not. There's
right
plenty of thinking and feeling here too, right?
Right. It's a great question that also ties with world five, where this world ends up being by far the most complex and intertwined and not purely action, clearly not purely action. And that some people that emerges as one of the greatest qualities of this world specifically. In other words, historically, and this is one of the contributions of, I would say, modern Hasidism, the past 300 years has been this layer that has been contributed. And historically, there have been those that have always felt that the spiritual worlds are greater than this world. And this question flips that on its head and says that this world is those worlds plus. You understand? So there is an element there that there's something here that is by far more unique than anywhere else.
Yeah. So the way that it's explained, there's right four, or I guess five worlds, and they almost feel like step functions rather than kind of a spectrum. What occupies, if you could call it, space between the worlds?
Like, where do you graduate from one to the next?
Meaning that the way I'm either visualizing it, right, there's four kind of, right, descending worlds. But what is in between these worlds?
We interface.
Or are they completely connected?
Like what separates?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think you're asking a great question.
You see what I'm saying?
I understand what you're asking. To illustrate your question, in our system of the four worlds, our very personal system is our spirituality, our soul, then our mind, then our emotion, and then our body. Where does something go from physical to emotional? It seems like they're two different worlds, but it seems like where they touch, they kind of get murky in between, where they feed into each other. And then the same thing where it goes from emotional to intellectual. It seems that something, it's not purely emotional and then suddenly it's purely intellectual.
Right.
It doesn't seem that it's so hard on the edges, right? It seems that there's more of a soft mesh in between. Talking it through now, I think that one of the systems that we're going to talk about, system number two in our soul, is that the bottom of each world is actually the beginning of the next world. So that there is a murky water that transitions. There's a transitioner where suddenly it starts.
So it is a spectrum. Basically.
It's a spectrum.
And that's also from the fifth to the first.
Right. The fifth to the first.
And like now again.
Goes two systems. It goes one, and then it also has a override system. This is a. I'll tell you, I was in yeshiva once, and somebody, you know, we were talking about these things, and one of the rabbis that was there, but one of the students took notes, and he put all that, you know, because each one of these things is that there's names and words and Hebrew words and English words, and he had like pipes, he made a whole pipes, and the name was Rabbi Bard. He says Rabbi Bard's plumbing system.
Yeah, like
Yes.
Just wondering, it reminded me a little bit of Maimonides and Shepa Shofea Me'Hashem.
Yes.
That wisdom. And it seems to me that the description of angels seems to be that what flows down is these individual rays that are very distinct. And what we catch is whatever we can catch of the entire area.
There's something there.
Okay.
Yes?
I'll take something interesting that occurred to me earlier on in this in the talk. It's just they're talking about the spirituality and the different dimensions, whatever. I don't know if you guys ever seen the movie Interstellar.
Yeah.
The movie. There's a really amazing sequence towards the end of the movie where this guy's like sort of stuck in some interdimensional thing with time. Like he's like, you see all these individual frames of time.
Mm-hmm.
Like every moment of something. And like, as visualizing like these boxes or whatever, a movement or whatever it is. And he's trying to get to the other side, back to this world. And his daughter's in this world. And he's trying to get her attention. He pushes a book through a bookshelf. And all this, it just reminded me of this. Your talk did remind me of that movie. Where, how the worlds are interconnected and how they interact with each other and talk to each other.
Maybe I should have gone into directing.
the movie was, the trigger was written by a world famous physicist.
Yeah, right? Yeah. This is all colliding with
it's
the water.
One of the amazing things about this stuff is a lot of this is written in Mishnah.
It's interacting.
In the days of the Mishnah, exactly. We're talking about 2,000 years, literally 2,000 years ago. And today, the Tzar actually writes that the year coincides to like the late 1800s, 1890s, somewhere there, where there's going to be an expansion of knowledge. He writes that as a prediction. And we assume that to be reflecting the expansion of the knowledge of physics, which happened in the past 100, 200 years, which a lot of it suddenly that has been written so long ago comes to life, like so obviously now, you know? Which is pretty incredible. Yes.
You mentioned your uncle had such an extensive library. Did he read books on modern physics?
Of course. He was up to date on everything. On everything. Yep. Even in his Talmud, you can see that he'll have... He translated the Talmud to English. Well, to Hebrew first. And alone, you know, the art scroll did it, but with a whole team of like 30 people, and every tractate is done. This guy did it himself over some 35 years. And a lot of the, you know, there's different episodes that happen in the Talmud that he'll crisscross with ideas and references that he's found just from other things. A small example that comes to mind is there's a disease from getting bitten by a dog. Help me out here.
Rabies.
Well, not only a dog, but from some animals.
Thanks.
That the Talmud describes. And he wrote this, I don't know, 30, 40 years ago, as clearly a match to a diagnosis that exists today. Something which I don't know how many rabbis would have been able to tie together. But his knowledge was just there. He saw it as obvious. That's like, you know, a small thing. History, it was one of a kind.
You have been listening to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles. If you enjoy these podcasts, we invite you to write a review on the Apple Podcast site or wherever you get your podcasts. For more information about Temple Beth Am, Los Angeles, go to tbala.org.